Where are you feeding the athlete a safe, scalable exposure to all of the different ways that their structure can end up interacting with another athlete? And that's where something like contact improv or roughhousing, where martial arts can be extraordinarily valuable. And that's where I would say that what we're doing with roughhousing is a better donor sport to athleticism in general than any specific martial art is.
That was Rafe Kelly, and you're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast. Today's podcast is sponsored by the Plyomat. The Plyomat is not only an incredible vertical jump and reactive strength index testing device, but it also is an incredible training device. The Plyomat not only allows single response jumps, but also the chaining of multiple mats together. So you can use it for bounding, multiple series of hurdle hops. And you can get not only height, but reactive strength for a multi-jump situation. It's an incredible, again, testing and training tool. And you can learn more at plyomat.net. Welcome to another episode of the show. Thanks for being here. And our guest today is Rafe Kelly. He is the owner of Evolve Move Play. He has studied and taught a multitude of movement practices and sport practices spanning gymnastics, martial arts, parkour, weightlifting, and more for over 20 years. And Rafe has had a profound impact on my own viewpoint of movement and human performance. So much of modern training is highly prescriptive, very reliant on drills, and although winning is certainly important, it's also overemphasized, especially early on. And all of this can lead to a downplay of creativity and exploration in athletes, their intuition and learning ability, as well as lowering the ceiling of movement and skill potential. On today's show, Rafe will highlight methods to foster creativity, improvisation, and intuition in movement and sport that not only leads to a more expansive learning process, a higher skill ceiling, but also a stronger connection with the joy of movement and the reason we began training, moving, and playing in the first place. Excited to get to this one, so let's start episode 406 with Rafe Kelly. Something I wanted to ask you, and you had said this, I think it was back on the first podcast we did together. It was something like the Tao or the balance is somewhere between chaos and structure. And this is, to me, interesting with play, in the sense of like, well, what should our practices look like? And I think for something like parkour, I mean, it's all, I mean, there's skills for sure, but it's all at its heart, it is like a joyful, like more, it seems to me, at least from my perspective, more exploration, more play-like than perhaps other practices. Like, for example, like if we're just going to work on block starts and track, like, and so I know you mentioned like coaching martial arts, and I was curious, because to me, that is something that there's still play, certainly, but it's a little bit more like, all right, this is at the end of the day, here's the box, these are the rules, and this is the competition here. So what's kind of the balance in something like that? How do you look at the balance? And you've talked to, like in martial arts, like kata, just sitting there and like punching. How do you find that balance in coaching and what's appropriate between play and then more structured activities?
Man, I kind of want to go a lot of different directions. When you started talking about chaos and order and play, I started thinking about like cognitive science and work around how the brain actually works as a balancing agent between chaos and order. So self-organized criticality and how we actually just act as intelligent agents in the world. So I don't know if you want to dig into that. It might take me a second to really like call up coherence for. And then as far as the balance between play and perhaps discipline or structure, and then how you apply that in coaching. So one of the things that there's something strange about our culture that we don't realize that play is always inherently a structured activity. There's a concept in motor learning and you know, cognitive science of enabling constraints, right? So you set up a constraint, and that actually opens up the possibility space that you're going to play within. So soccer works because there's a set of constraints. You can't pick the ball up with your hands unless you're the goalie, right? The goal is to get the ball in the goal, right? It's not to get the ball somewhere else. You use a specific type of ball. There's a specific number of people on the field. Like, all of those are structures that allow the game to then exist. But then there's this immense, there's actually an infinite set of degrees of freedom that are available once that structure is in place. So every soccer game is different than any other previous soccer game. And that's what makes it endlessly rewarding for people to play, for people who enjoy soccer. And the same is true of chess. The same is true of parkour, right? So you're always playing with these two things. Generally, if you have, you know, the classic example of like an unstructured thing would be like people show up to train with you and you're just like, have fun. Like, there's nothing, right? Like, what are they going to do? Like anybody who's worked with a coach or has been a coach, like, knows that, like, coaching is at least something more than saying, do whatever you want. Right? Now, in some sense, I'm almost going back on that, because with children, it can be do whatever you want, but the constraints are provided by the environment. So I take my kids to the Ninja Warrior Gym, the gym that I was telling you about. It's kind of a parkour Ninja Warrior gym here in Bellingham. And generally, the most common sort of thing is we get there, and often the gym has been slightly changed, and the kids see the novel things there, and they go and they just start moving, and they just follow their joy. Now, in this sense, it's not that it's totally unconstrained, because what's happened is that the physical constraints, the environmental constraints, have been shifted, and the children are inherently interested in exploring those constraints and seeing what's available now. It's kind of like a treat to get, okay, new set of constraints to play with. And I remember listening to, I think, one of your interviews with Jeremy Frisch, where he talked about the same thing, that like, if you set up the environment and children come in and they start playing and they create their own games, then you've already done your job as a coach. You don't have to give them anything else. But in some sense you have, because like when we walk into the gym, right, it's a physically constrained space. So it has a meaning that has been communicated to the children over time, right? They've gone in there and repeatedly had access to specific types of movement. They walk in and they see lots of other people who are engaging in the same type of movement, and it communicates, you can do this type of thing here. And so you don't actually have to then tell them, you can do this type of thing here, or this is a thing that you should do. You just let them explore that. And then if you've taught them games, or taught them drills, or taught them ways to move, then you've created an affordance for them that they can explore on their own. So yesterday I got together with a group of my students, people who've been at retreats with me. We had, I think, 12 people who came out to the park at Volunteer Park. And a lot of us hadn't seen each other in a while. It was the first like really warm day of the spring. It was like almost 70 degrees in Seattle. So we got together and it was still cold underneath the trees. So we all went out in the sun on the grass next to these really amazing trees that we like to move in. And people started warming up. And so everybody was doing little versions of joint mobility stuff, some basic calisthenics types exercises, stretching. And we all ended up in a circle, kind of facing each other. And then somebody in the circle just ran across the circle and tackled somebody else. And they started wrestling, and then somebody else brought out a stick and people started playing games of avoiding the stick. And then I brought out the practice balls and some folks started doing practice ball drills. And so there's a, I didn't have to provide any structure in that space because there's a common language that had been built up and it could just happen. Right. And then we went over to the trees and we started playing with the vocabulary in the trees. And that can be great, right? That can be great. Now, if you're trying to achieve a really specific adaptation for an athlete, then you're going to need to dial in more tightly. So if my goal was to jump farther, that session didn't do very much for me, right? It was good. It was good general fitness. It was fun. It was highly motivating. But I didn't do a lot of work that is specific to jumping farther. And so if my goals are contingent on being able to jump farther, then I need to set up things in my sessions that are going to address that. So what the way that my training tends to work, and this is also sort of how I work with my kids a lot, is we'll set a few goals that are kind of what we're working on for a period of time. So like for me, it was a corkscrew, or it was the parkour climb up, or it was speed runs. And I'd be like, okay, so I've got 90 minutes where I'm going to be in the gym. So half an hour of that is going to be devoted to these core things. 20 minutes of it is going to be a warm-up that's going to prepare my body for the session. And then the rest of the time is going to be whatever's fun. And so a lot of times the way my training looks is like, I'll go in and, you know, the space will be set up in a new way and I'll start exploring. Hey, it looks like I could swing from here to there. And then here's a vault that I can do. And then here's a jump and I could do this precision. And then I'll be like, okay, maybe I can link all of these. And that's sort of like, okay, that line now feels like it's teaching me this set of things that I want to learn, but it's not addressing this other thing that I want to do. So I'm going to go to this other part of the gym, and that's where I'm going to maybe work on my acrobatics. I'm going to go to this other part of the gym and work on climbing. And then I'll just rotate through those things. And as part of that rotation, I'll stop and do like one of the core elements, right? It's like here, I'm just doing the climbing. So usually I'll have three kind of areas that I'm working in, and then one like just core skill that I'm trying to dial in. And I'll go through that, you know, and then the one core skill might be climb ups for a certain segment of the session, and then corkscrews for a certain segment and the next thing. So then with my kids, when they come to the gym with me, as we drive up, I'll say, hey, is there anything you're excited to practice? And they'll say, oh, I want to practice this. I want to practice that. And so then we'll go in and they'll just scatter and they're doing their own thing. And I'll tell them, when you're ready for me to help you with something, come find me. And so they'll come over and they'll say, hey, Dad, will you work on this with me? Or they'll say, hey, Dad, I don't know what to do. I'm bored now. Or Dad, can you give me a challenge? And that's when I start to feed them something specific. And so then at the end of the session, I'll ask them, what was your rose, your bud, and your thorn from the session? And so the rose is that they get to recognize the moment of the session that was most rewarding. The thorn is like, hey, what is something that, you know, you're upset by that you need to get out of? And then the bud is, what do you want to keep working on? What aspiration was invited to you? So they get to reflect on how, what they want to hold going forward from that session to the next session. So that's some of the ways that I play with giving lots of space for variation to arise and for novel to be explored and for intrinsic motivation to drive sessions, but also linking in a kind of core progressions and it's kind of the idea of the future self, right? Like there's what you want in the present, and then there's kind of how you would like to continue to be And then being able to continue to be aware of and ask, okay, did I show up for that? Did I show up the way that I wanted to be able to get the things that I want in the future? And did I learn something that will help me go adjust those future goals? So that was kind of a long diatribe. You also asked me about martial arts, so we can come back to that. But that was the answer, sure, that I had for there.
Yeah, I do think I do still find it humorous, like the coach. You don't really see it in the coaching playbook too much. Hey, just do what you want today. Like, here's the ball. Like, although I will say I actually have seen like youth coaching situations for like the youth speed class where the kids are much better off before the coach actually comes in and starts doing, you know, before the coach comes in, they're doing like cartwheels and playing tag and wrestling. And then the coach comes in with the speed ladder and they're just mimicking, you know, the basic drills that don't have quite as much richness to them. But yeah, like, I think, the thing you said, like following your joy or training based off like the fuel of following your joy. And then, but you also have to look like, I guess you could say KPIs or key abilities, things or abilities that do take focus. And it's like, okay, look, to level this ability up here, it's going to take a little bit more. It's or just finding ways to channel. Maybe it's organic or maybe it's planned. You know, I guess maybe that's the trick. Is it something you actually set time, boom, 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 now we're going to do this? Or maybe the trick is to find it to organically flow into that, you know, and then it kind of gets taken care of on its own.
I think it definitely just depends on the athlete, the sport.
Yeah, for sure. Right?
Training age. Like, there's a lot of things that depend on kind of where your need is, right? Like, if I was working with MMA fighters and they were out of camp versus like 2 weeks out of a fight, it's going to be a completely different situation, right? I think that, you know, in the martial arts context, it can be quite playful, actually. I think that a lot of the authenticity in movement and the kind of movement creativity that makes really successful fighters like an Israel Adesanya, Sean O'Malley, it comes out of a play.
Yeah.
A place of play, right? And I think that, you know, like Sean Strickland also, you know, he just likes sparring so much. And so he develops a unique and weird style that really works for him, because he's in there figuring out how his attributes, his structure works in relationship to other people over and over and over. Right? And so I think that having the athletes come in and really letting them be playful and feeding it can be really powerful. Just sort of like, instead of, okay, now everybody do your egg beaters and everybody do your runs or whatever. It's like, if you set a culture where people come in and just start playing with each other, and then you could say, hey, okay, here's some intentions, here's some goals. Or you can just ask the students, right? Like, what do you feel like you need to improve on? Right? Like, I'm trying to imagine this in a kind of like a track and field context. So working with kids like to play tag. You get them down there, they're wrestling, they're playing tag. Okay, this is great. Rather than taking them out of that and taking them right to structure, like, how could you shape that and say, sweet, we're playing tag. How do we add a little bit more speed demand to that tag? Right? How do we structure it? How about we play a version of tag that looks like this, and then it's creating this thing that you're looking for. Right? Like, we take it over to the track, play rabbit drills. Right? Here's an idea, like a tempo run thing. So you're walking around the track with somebody, and for a set period of time, you get to chase them. And then you have to not chase them. We've done this with parkour. This is a game that I started developing in parkour. So we used to play follow the leader in parkour. Now, if you just play follow the leader, it breaks down fairly fast, because the movements that you want to do require big energy outputs, and you just get tired. And then everybody's just kind of tiredly zombieing through not very nice feeling routes. But I came up with this idea of like, walk between, like follow somebody and walk in the intermediate sessions. And then when they decide that they're going to do a route, they run and then you have to follow them. So now it's improvisational rather than like pre-planned. And so the athletes are doing that. They're doing an obstacle course where the leader has to come up with a series of movements and then they'll slow down and repeat. And then we added a competitive context to it, which is if I'm walking and you're behind me, you can't tag me. But as soon as I start running, you can tag me. And if you tag me, you get to move up my space in the line. So every time that I decide to take off and run through a route, I'm actually risking that you're going to catch me on that route. And I'm giving you the opportunity to try to catch me. So maybe there's a way that you could adapt that in like a track context where you're having athletes sprint, but they have like periods of time that they're allowed to sprint and periods of time that they can walk. And you know, you could, depending on the kind of athletes you're working with, you know, like if you're working with like pure short distance sprinters, you might not want to play a lot with those rest intervals. But if you're working with like middle distance runners, you could have a very interesting game where you're playing with athletes who can recover faster in between sets versus athletes who have more speed, and how that the faster, the more enduring athlete can kind of like use shorter rest periods to gain an advantage. I don't know. There's some ideas that are popping in my head for ways you could play with this.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there'd be plenty of middle distance runners who would thank you for making a very difficult workout a little bit more like, at least there's stuff going on, you know, to try to figure out, to try to gamify this. And I mean, even just watching like the output of children when it's a game versus like, if you were to tell a bunch of 5-year-olds, hey, go run as fast as you can around the track. Well, one, they wouldn't see the point. So they really wouldn't want to. Some might, but you wouldn't see a very much output, nor really should you. But if it was a game somehow where they were chasing somebody around, or or even just what I see out of them coaching like 5, 6, 7-year-old soccer players, you see a tremendous output just because it's so task driven and they aren't even thinking about it. And I mean, that's I think it would be interesting too for track to almost start with like a square game and then turn it into like a long rectangular like type game, like could be tag or something else where the long sprints were encouraged, like it just kind of organically encouraged it. And then you took that into actual timed efforts to take the time into it. You said a few things I thought were really, I think even outside of track into team sport, because I think for me, and I intuitively see like how I missed some of these things, which is like I was much better at track than I was at basketball, even though I spent far more time as a young athlete on basketball. And it's like, well, what was I missing? What did I just not have? And I think one is a little earlier exposure and a little more like variety of competitive experiences in basketball earlier on. But the creative expression, like Jeremy Frisch has talked about, like for basketball, you used to just play 3-on-3 in the off season, or like that would be an ideal thing, not to go do like AAU or something, or just to keep playing the same version of the game, because in 3-on-3, it's more creative affordances. And a lot of times it's more like low key, you have more freedom to explore. But you said something that I also think is, I think fits in there with things that to be given the athlete or considered, especially for team sports. And that was improvisation. You had talked about how to make the drill improvisational, because I think the vast majority of all drills or constraints or setups given to team sport athletes, it's like, okay, you go here, you go here, you guard this person. The game is very fixed versus the improvisational, like you were mentioning, it's like, it sounded like, you know, there's kind of a swarm of people, but when one person breaks off and improvises, then you follow them. And just to have a little bit more like chaos. And I know, you know, in my time, I remember at Return of the Source, you know, the first time movement improv was talked about, I was like, I don't even know what this is. Like, someone explained this to me. But I think in the sense that I'm so naturally, I can just tell, I think the same thing that reason I may struggle with that concept, even just in general, I think I struggled with the same thing in sport. And in the sense too, where like I played basketball and I wanted to dunk. And I was very good at doing dunks when there weren't other players around. But as soon as there's players and there's stuff going on and chaos, I just couldn't. And I think my brain just shut down when there was too much of that. And it didn't embrace it. So, so there was just something. And I think that, you know, kind of filtered out to all other aspects of the game. But just long story short is I just think that the improvisational piece of movement, I think, could filter into athletics too. And I think it's not something that, because I guess, would you say that's separate than creativity in some sense of the word, perhaps? I'm not sure. I mean, it is creative, but it's also like, I mean, is it something that it's almost more like random, like creatively at random? I'm not sure how to put that.
Creativity, like psychometrically, like one, creativity has been fairly difficult to define. But one way that they look at it in psychology is something where they basically give you a task of like looking at it something and saying, how many ways could I use this? So, okay, this is a mug I can drink out of it, right? It's a weapon. I can smash someone's head with it. It's a doorstop. It's a, I can hold down the pages of a book with it, right? Could use it as a hat in a silly play. Right. So you can kind of judge creativity that way. It seems to me that creativity is very close to what we're talking about as far as improvisation. Improvisation is basically the ability to create a solution to a problem as it's happening. Right. That's what we're looking at for, at least in the sport context, right? So we can look at it as someone like Barry Sanders, right? And say, okay, he's doing things in the moment based on how the field is lining up for him, right? What made Barry Sanders special wasn't that he ran a set play better than anybody else, right? It's not that he, you know, he was just slightly quicker and faster into his cuts or something. It was that he could look at three tacklers lining up to get him, and in the moment, juke one and know how to respond and be in position to juke the next one, right? And all those athletes are moving at different speeds with different body proportions, coming at them from different angles. It's like no amount of ladder drills is going to get you there. I was really interested in this when I started Evolve Move Play, you know, over a decade ago. Like the idea of open skill versus closed skill is one way that this was described, right? So all team sports are basically open skill. Now, a set play in basketball is more closed than a fast break. But it's still open skill because the way that the defense is defending the set play is going to be different at some level every time, right? Even just the physical athletes, right? So if you're trying to, say, lob a dunk on a, you know, sidelines out of bounds play, and Victor Wembanyama is guarding the middle of the floor, you know, that's a whole different challenge than if it's Aaron Gordon guarding the middle of the floor. So even if the athletes are theoretically, in some sense, playing exactly the same roles, have exactly the same strategies, the physical dimensions of the athletes are different. And as soon as the play starts rolling, the speed at which each individual as athlete is moving, there's noise in how they're getting from one space to another, there's random variability. And the each individual athlete in trying to play their role is having to improvise to some degree in order to achieve the specific goal that they've been given, even within that closed set play. And that's how football mostly works, right? Football is mostly like a designed play that every individual, like 22 people, then are all reacting to chaotic changing conditions as they try to play out their assigned role. And then a lot of times, and then, you know, the play is breaking and then you're moving through your progressions if you're like a quarterback or whatever. That's all improvisational. And then, of course, once a play breaks completely, that's what they call, you know, street football.
Yeah.
Right. Now the wide receiver's broken off his routes. The linemen are super confused trying to figure out where they are. Quarterback's rolling out, and he's just trying to find someone who's figured out how to get open. Right. So I got interested in that because parkour theoretically was about reach or escape. But we tended to practice in a relatively closed manner, more like gymnasts, right? A gymnast does a routine, they do the same exact thing. A gymnastics floor, like there's noise in the athlete's movement always, right? So a gymnast who's doing a high bar routine is actually adjusting constantly to try to achieve the goal. They're not doing the exact same thing because they slightly overswung this swing. They're a little bit too fast here and have to adjust. But that's far less chaotic than another player. Parkour is in an interesting kind of liminal zone because we're really dealing with the environment being variable from iteration to iteration. So we don't go to the same high bar. We go to a different bar that feels differently, right? And so then we're learning to adjust to that. But it's happening much slower than the adjustment that's happening in a team sport situation. And so the question that came up for me was basically, how do we, if we really need to run away from somebody, or if we really need to chase somebody down, are we actually getting all the adaptation that we need? So can we play with parkour more like a team open sport situation? And then I discovered contact improvisation dance, which I think is what you're referring to. And it gave me a set of tools for using player interactions to get people to start trying out novel movement solutions. You know, we can do that in a parkour context using parkour movements, but you can use that sort of set of tools to to address actually many different types of problems for an athlete.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Lila Exogen Wearable Resistance. Exogen is used by coaches such as Randy Huntington and Chris Corfist and is an incredible tool in overloading the angular momentum and speed aspect of human movement. You can get 25% off of Exogen sleeves by heading to lilateam.com and using the code JustFly25. If you're a coach looking for an awesome training portal to distribute and track workouts for athletes online or in person, then you can get a free 30-day trial of Team Builder software by heading to teambuilder.com and using the code JustFly. See what Team Builder can do for you and sign up for that free trial today using the code JustFly. Yeah, I think that I wonder sometimes how, like with the improvisation or being more of a track person when there's less, like, I mean, like you said, there's improvisation, like there's those day-to-day subtle differences and things like it's certainly there. Like you certainly, like you can never truly coast whatever the skill is, but there's mm-hmm. less chaos than other things. And yeah, I was wondering if like, you know, the contact improv or for myself, like I doing dance moves, like on my own, if it's like a party, like I can do some moves that some people would think are cool, but dancing with another person, I struggle with far more. And I almost wonder if that fits with a team sport situation. Like it's almost like you're dancing with an entire, like basically a whole body of engagement and various things. And so I do wonder, and I wonder, yeah, if I would have had an upbringing that was more like, you know, there was more dance involved or I was taught some of these things. If anything, I think sometimes that an athlete, it's not how you behave on the court. It's not just X's and O's and go here and there. There's a piece that digs into your psychology as well and how you interact with another human being on a basic level, I believe. So I that was something that I've just been kind of thinking of and I think is interesting. I think we'll probably talk about that with roughhousing as well here.
Yeah. For some reason, what pops into my mind is Nikola Jokic. Right. Like, I think Nikola Jokic orchestrates basketball as a team dance better than anybody we've ever seen. And what he has, you know, it's from, have you ever heard of the term type one athleticism versus type two athleticism?
I don't think so.
So type one athleticism would be like the classic things we expect. Can you jump high? Can you run fast? Can you hit hard? And type two athleticism is like more basically fine motor coordination. Do you have soft hands? Do you have precise hands? Can you, can you hit something really targeted? So it turns out that there's a pretty strong correlation, say, between how fast someone can run and how high they can jump. There isn't that much correlation between how fast someone runs and how likely they are to hit a target when playing darts. But there's a good correlation between how good you are at darts and billiards, right? Or pool.
Yeah.
So, the optimal team sport athlete, in some sense, has a lot of both.
Mm-hmm.
But we tend to fall in love with expressions of type one athleticism. So what I think made like Michael Jordan remarkable is that he was basically probably the best type one athlete in the NBA. And, you know, he was one of the maybe top five in the world, right? It was like him, Carl Lewis, Bo Jackson, right? There's a few guys who were just absolutely absurd in their just pure running, jumping, power, hitting stuff at that time and place. But Jordan was probably like in the top 15 most skillful guys, right? In the way that he moved, in his fluidity, his ease of action. Nikola Jokic is remarkable because he's not a very good type one athlete, right? He's a better type one athlete than people realize because he's extremely balanced. He's quite enduring, right? Like what makes him really interesting is he's actually a great off ball player, and he's screening and rescreening and he's moving out and he's attacking space, and he doesn't actually need the ball in order to manipulate the game. And that requires a lot of output. And so he's actually like has high cardiorespiratory ability in order to do what he does. He doesn't idle a lot on the court. And he's not easily bumped off. He's very strong, but like he doesn't jump high, right? You have a 7-footer who dominates in the paint and has like one of the lowest dunk rates we've ever seen. But his hands are softer and better than anybody else's. And his vision is incredible, right? And so he can throw these touch passes. And he can, you know, have something come in and throw it off to somebody and it goes exactly where he wants it to go without him even looking where he wants it to go, right? And so it's this extraordinary aspect of type two athleticism. And what, you know, to connect it back to that idea of dance, what allows him to do is that he's able to attune to everyone else on the team incredibly well. So he conducts what his team is doing at an extraordinary level. And I do think that in some sense, that's exactly the type of thing that's cultivated in dance. Right? I've been learning to swing dance right now. So I'm practicing playing the lead. And so a lead, you know, kind of like theoretically the lead decides what's happening. But the lead's role isn't so much to just decide what's happening, but actually to recognize the type of thing that the follow wants to do and provide a frame in which the follow can do that. And so there's these basic rules around how you ask a question physically, basically, and how you provide a structure that someone can work with. So if you're really stiff and like forceful in the way that you ask for things, it doesn't work well. But on the other hand, if you're soft, then there's no communication. So you do this basic drill of like holding each other's hands and trying to move each other. And you can feel like, okay, we get really stiff, it's awkward. If we're super soft and receptive, then when you push on me, there's no communication, right? My body can't respond if my arm is just a noodle. and those types of sensitivities to how we interact with other people and how that creates an affordance. I don't know. I guess I'm just fascinated by it.
Yeah. I'm sure there's got to be some, you know, some level of correlation at some point. I mean, obviously, you can't take it too far because then the best answers would be the best, you know, overall. There's different aspects of athleticism, but I 100% can see that. And I think, you know, how we move is mirrored in everything. And it's, yeah, like I had mentioned before, I think that what I've seen in the movement improv and just understanding that and the dance, I'm like, I see this in how I play sports. You know, I think I feel more comfortable and natural in sports, but there's certainly shades of it there. And then with like the rhythm piece as well, and being able to do things with like a rhythmic quality and infusing music. Let's like take that into roughhousing though a little bit, because I know we wanted to talk about that. Because obviously, what better medium to experience a lot of these things in? And I know you were just on Jordan Peterson's podcast not too long ago talking about roughhousing. I know we've discussed it at least a little bit on the podcast in your previous appearances, but just from like a general perspective, with roughhousing, this was actually a question. I think it might be something I brought up before the show, but just kind of as an inlet to athleticism, if athleticism is the topic, there's a lot of like contact drills, like contact sports or whatnot, you're going to have certain like, all right, football players, you're going to get down to bear crawl and go shoulder to shoulder and try to push the other person off the line or something like that. It's like definitive setup, definitive exit point. But, what do you see like with roughhousing that, the layers that might go further than that.
Yeah. Let's back up for a second and come back to like what's currently happening in team sport and how we could maybe understand it better. But first, I think it's really useful to understand that we have inherent drives to play. The reason that we have football is because it answers some inherent drive to play that we have. And so all of it sort of arises from this fundamental predecessor of the inherent human drive for play. And different species play in ways that are specific to that species because it reflects evolved aspects of their niche, right? Why are quarterbacks so sexy? Why do we put that in there? Well, human beings are the only thing that throws effectively at moving targets at high speed, right? It's a hunting skill. So it reflects something really, you know, unique about a human being. A human being is a super predator because of our capacity to do what quarterbacks do. Now, in my work, in my early exploration of natural movement was influenced by Georges Hébert from Méthode Naturelle, and he talked about basically the fundamental movement capacities were walk, run, jump, climb, move on all fours, balance, swim, lift, throw, and defend yourself. So 10 core capacities. Eventually, I realized that you could essentially break those down into locomotion, manipulation, and combat. And I discovered that Margaret Stryker, a movement thinker from the 1930s, had also broken it down into those. She viewed combat as a form of manipulation. But I didn't know where to put dance in that. So then eventually I started to sort of expand I took the combat segment and said, what if we call this interaction? And then we can see that you have interaction in a team sport, right? Like, a pick and roll between two players is interactive, right? There, it's combative with the other team, and then it's interactive between those two players. Dance, just shared work. Then when I started digging deeply into the play research, I realized that this was all already in play as well. So there's basically three fundamental forms of movement or motor play that play researchers have developed. Exploratory locomotor play. So every child will run, jump, climb, crawl, and explore their environment, right? Given the chance. Balance, swim, all those things that George Hébert talked about. Every child will also do object-oriented play. They will grab balls and throw them. And, you know, like if you've seen a little baby, you see how interested they get in a ball or a block or a toy. That's relatively unique to human beings. You don't see that as much in other animals. But human beings are extremely exploratory of what we can do with other objects. And then you have rough and tumble play. And so rough and tumble play is chasing, tackling, wrestling, striking, etc. And then you have things like pretend play and narrative play and etc. But just in the, those are the fundamental motor play areas. And then you have dance, which you could view as a form of play. And interestingly, dance kind of exists on in all of those levels, because you can do locomotive dance, you can do object-oriented dance, you can, you know, do contact juggling dance, and you can do interactive dance. So if you look at the interactive level, then you have, you can chase, you can tackle, you can do this, and then you can do it in acrobatics. Kids love to be thrown and tossed and twisted and flipped in the air. So we know that children love rough and tumble play. We know that it improves their capacity for empathy and improves their general physical capacities. It's highly motivational for them, really good for kids with behavioral problems. And we know that, like, I would say that the reason we enjoy something like football is because it allows us to do this. So a football player, you know, needs to have some fundamental locomotive skills, run, jump, maybe move on all fours, hit the ground, break falling, super important. They need to have ball manipulation skills, unless they're a lineman. And then they need to be able to cooperate and combat, right? Stiff arm, juke, and, you know where that other lineman is. You know when you need to block, know how to run upfield, right? My son's playing rugby, and he's a U10 in rugby, and it's like getting the kids to know where to run to be the outlet pass available, right? Instead of like lining up behind the ball or standing around doing nothing while their friend runs down the field. It's like, how do I read the defense and read the athlete who has the ball so that I can show up in a position where he can get the ball to me? Or if I'm not the one, if someone else has taken that position, how do I feed that, right? And be able to see that down the line. So that's kind of the background that I think is really important to understand. These are fundamental forms of play. They have an inherent structure that exists in children's play that we can study that most people aren't aware of. And they have profound developmental capacity when we use them. And there's dynamics within rough and tumble play that we see in children that are not usually seen in team structure or like adult structured team sport or martial arts. And a lot of those things are now being explored sort of in the space of movement culture, contact improv, et cetera. And so I don't know if you want to feed any questions in there, but I can, that's a good place to start.
Yeah. So I think kind of along what you just said, and what I was mentioning is, and this is something that I think it fits with a little bit of what we've been talking about the whole conversation, but play and roughhousing, on some level, like in a competitive situation, it's always compete to win. So if there's a roughhousing situation for sport, it's always going to be, can I push you off the line, et cetera, et cetera. But I think if you could scale that down to like playing so the other person has a good time as well, or if you know you're going to win, like almost like letting off a little bit so that so you both can learn and level up appropriately. Was this something that, like in the martial arts, are there adaptations of this? Because I would imagine that the martial arts is obviously contact, something that maybe there's more roughhousing adaptations that would lend to, like, how do we mutually grow in this situation? We're competing, but we're also just kind of like trying to make each other better at the same time, too, if that makes sense. Like, kind of that symbiosis between the two.
So one of the things you discovered with contact improv is that it allows removing the competitive intent or creating a creative intent allows you to explore spaces that you would avoid if you were trying to win the local interaction, right? So like if we think about Brazilian jiu-jitsu, right? I do not want someone to have back control on me. So if I can win all the interactions that lead to me not getting someone on my back, I'm going to win the local game. But if I never have anyone on my back, then as soon as I lose the game that leads to the person on my back, then I'm without skill. So I need to be exposed to situations where I have people on my back. Now, we can structure it by like that by just saying, hey, the game starts with someone on your back, right? The game starts here. But the other thing that we can do is we can play games where we're exploring space and how we move with each other in a broader way. And now I'm going to have a developed set of kinesthetic maps for how another body interacts with my body when someone is on my back. So if I'm doing contact improv, I have lots of ways of using my back to somebody else to facilitate, you know, cool movements. All right. So by going that broad and that general in some sense, we're expanding just the general capacity for movement and awareness of the body and how it interacts with somebody else. So what happens a lot in martial arts, and I suspect this is true in football and team sport, is there's an idea of a correct technique, right? So I'm going to teach you a few sets of techniques that are going to allow you to win the interaction in, you know, lining up and trying to get, you know, blow past the offensive lineman to get to the quarterback. But the reality on the field is that a lot of times you're going to end up in positions that you're not used to. You're going to fall down. You're going to get twisted around. You're going to be double teamed. You're going to get rolled up on. And then you're going to have to react from this place that you are not used to, right? That you didn't drill, that you don't have a technique for. And so having this sort of general feeder for movement creativity means that you'll have more options available to you to improvise off of. So playing something that actually doesn't have a competitive intent at all, but that exposes you to all of these positions and all of these capacities to move, can create an athlete with higher movement abundance. Use Nikolai Bernstein type idea. Now, the next layer down would be, instead of drilling something statically or completely competitively, one of the really brilliant tools I think out there is I originally thought of this as like playing offense defense, or the kind of, in traditional martial arts they talk about the uke, which is the receiver of the technique. So, you know, you've all seen this maybe with Aikido. Somebody lines up with some ridiculous over-the-head strike that looks like a sword that nobody would ever throw, and then the other guy throws him, right? So that person who's feeding the strike is called the uke. And the problem in a lot of martial arts is that the uke is feeding something that's completely unrelated to what you'd actually experience. So I call those broken uke dynamics. But I've been playing a lot with like, well, how can we use the uke in a way that it's progressive, in the same way that we would use progressive overload in like strength training? So I feel like people just really don't understand progressive overload in more complex movement dynamics. People see somebody jump between two buildings in parkour, and they're like, oh, I'd break my leg if I did parkour. And it's like, well, yeah, you'd break your leg if you try to squat 1,000 pounds too. Don't try to squat 1,000 pounds the first time you squat. Squat something that's reasonable. Do a jump that's reasonable for you. And so in the same way, like if you're just like, okay, you know, Mike Tyson, hit me as hard as you can, like you're not going to learn anything from that interaction. But if you say, but what we can do is we could take something as big and weird as an Aikido strike, and we can realize that that's actually just step one. So if you're somebody who, say, has a lot of fear of being hit, doesn't have good, like, good comfort with your eyes, like what you'll see is as soon as something is moving towards someone's face, their eyes are going to start closing and they're not going to have visual contact. So one of the first things is just being able to see what's happening longer and more effectively with less reaction when you're striking. So by throwing a strike that's very, very obvious at you, I'm going to be able to start to desensitize you to the idea of a strike moving at you. And then I can scale that strike. I can make that strike more and more realistic over time. So I can scale it by making it less telegraphed. So a real punch by a skilled person is not very telegraphed. A capoeira kick is usually very telegraphed. An Aikido uke attack is extremely telegraphed. But instead of saying, oh, that's just dumb, we're just going to spar, I could say, what if I actually understood that as a scaling mechanism? And now I can slowly learn to be more and more sophisticated in how I feed someone, such that I'm getting them to do the type of adaptation that I'm looking for progressively. And so now, this is a term that I got from Frank Francich, but I think it's the best term to think about this. What we're going to play with is a coach-athlete dynamic. The coach's role is to provide the environment that the athlete becomes skillful within. So if I am your coach in the learning to deal with a strike or a stiff arm or a swim move, right? I can adjust and I can become more sensitive and better at adjusting the speed, the force, the degree of telegraph, and the dynamics. Am I faking you out? Am I fainting? Right? The rhythm, right? Does it happen when you expect it to happen? And by doing that, I can now use that to scale up your ability to deal with the variations that you see. You do not deal with the variations in a defensive lineman's attack optimally by drilling the same exact movement pattern over and over again. You do it by seeing the variations that make you adaptive in the moment, right? So if you go back to that first thing of like, okay, we're going to push into each other's shoulders, that's fine. But what you could do instead is say, here's a dynamic that we're going to play with that's going to happen. And we're going to say, how could I teach my athletes so that they could understand how to scale their resistance in the various ways necessary to elicit the adaptations that are going to make that athlete more adaptive to the dynamics that actually exist in the game.
Yeah, I think scaling and continuums has been a topic that I'm continually thinking more and more about, especially I'd say ever since Rob Assis talked about like build up just skips and sprints and bounds, like where you start little and then let's say you're going for 30 meters and you just, all right, you're bounding or skipping and gradually get longer or higher or whatever. And it's funny because I actually took that for granted. I used to have sprint buildups. I mean, every track athlete's done a sprint buildup, you know, but I didn't think of it as that. It's just, oh, hey, we're doing sprint buildups, but it's like a continuum. And I've just been really appreciating more and more how that spectrum or buildup and what that teaches and has to offer. And you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about when I was playing basketball in high school. I remember I was a pretty good defender, like pretty skilled and adept at like dissecting, you know, moves and not letting people through or whatever. But I remember I think it was my senior year. For some reason, I was guarding our point guard who I usually or almost never guarded, and he would just blow me away with his moves. I had zero chance of stopping him. And I was just thinking to myself now, like, what would it take for me to reach a level where I could defend that individual? Because the only way in some respects, well, one, maybe I just need to play more basketball and guard a lot more people and, you know, start building those cognitive relays and perceiving what the move was going to be. But if it was just in that small situation and it was like a setup where you're trying to make the other person better, and it's like one-on-ones, it's like you're almost like work by scaling your attacks on the other person. Like start, and I don't know, like it's like on one end, it's like, do you really want to give them a chance? But it's almost like you're playing with the defender to see if they can stop it. Maybe starting easy. Okay, can you, like you said, scaling the aggression in martial arts. I just think that that's an interesting concept.
Yeah, I mean, so if that player is on your team, then he should want to teach you how to counter his bag in some sense, because that's going to allow you to do your job better to support him. So And yeah, you can do the exact same thing. So generally, like, as I understand it, I'm not like a basketball expert, but essentially the offensive player, what they're trying to do is to use multiple threats to get you to react in such a way that you open a window for them. So they can look away as if they're going to pass. They can cross you up one direction. They can cross you up the other. If you react this way, they're going to spin. So what is a scale for that? They can take away some of their counter to make it easier for you to solve the problem. So in jujitsu, right? Like my sort of beta for jujitsu at some point was almost everyone just looks at the size of me and my athleticism and they say, oh, I'm going to pull guard on this guy. I'm not going to try to fight him in the stand, right? So someone pulls guard on me and I'm going to, you know, force them to open their guard, but kick my hips back, whatever it is, wait till they open their guard. And then, you know, I'm going to knee slice through. I'm going to get side control and move to mount. Once I'm in mount or inside control, I'm going to threaten a collar choke. Once I'm threatening the collar choke, the athlete's going to react by moving to one side of their body, which is going to expose the potential to attack an armbar or take the back. So if I can attack the armbar, and if they react this way, move to a Kimura, or if they move this way, move to a, you know, a different attack, the more ways that I can then create threats from different positions, the less options they have, and the more easily I can close down the options they use. So I know jiu-jitsu better than basketball, but it's the same basic principle, right? And, you know, like Larry Bird used to do this to people. He used to say, I'm going to cross you up to the left and bank shot off the rim, right? And then he would do it. But a more advanced athlete who's trying to scale someone up can give them information that will help them solve the situation or can limit their own options. So this is, to complete the jiu-jitsu thing, this is something Keenan Cornelius said. Once you've reached a certain level of skill, most of the time you roll, you shouldn't be giving yourself the option of using all of your skills. You should be trying to limit yourself in some way in order to bring yourself to the specific things that you need to work on. And so you could say the same thing in a basketball context, right? Like, you know, the more skilled player, for instance, could say in their head, they don't need to tell you this, but they can just say, in my head, it only counts if I dunk. It only counts if I dunk. Everything that I do is just to get you to react so that I can blow past you and dunk. And if that's their only win condition, then they're going to end up constraining their behavior in a way that's going to make it more adaptive to you. And that's a simple way that they can play with actually giving themselves a challenge that levels up their skill, while at the same time simplifying the challenge and allowing you to level up your skill.
Yeah, I think that's just such a, yeah, across all sports and activities, something that, like, there's just this universal, like, how do you generally improve yourself as a skill? Like, this is how we do things to level up our skills, and that, like, handicapping yourself based off the person you're playing with. I mean, that's, as long as you don't offend them, you know? but that, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. I like that thought of, you know, Larry Bird, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to, it's funny because that could almost be a self-handicap too in some situations. I'm going to tell you the move I'm going to do, and then I'm still going to do it on you, because that probably requires a little more deception possibly, or the player like didn't really believe, is he really going to do that? I like
your body will react even if your mind thinks it's going to happen, right? So, right, if Larry Bird says, I'm going to cross you up to the left, and he starts the crossover, and you see the ball going to the right, and you feel his potential to go to the right, and you don't react, he's going to have you. And then you react, and he still has you, right? Mm-hmm. So it's pretty remarkable. But that is a good way to see, in some sense, to challenge yourself. Sorry, I lost my thought there. Oh,
that's okay. So I just love too how it's kind of like the generalist thing. Like if you're learning about skill building or just athleticism and the view of skill building, like the more sports and activities you can see it happening from, it just gives you such a better window. And I think the martial arts, I've thought about what the martial arts offers, just general, you could say athletic performance, but like one of the things just as we're talking, it's like that one-on-one contact piece. And like you said, like the scaling within that, there's obviously the human-to-human contact piece. I think there's so much to be learned that we can extrapolate out.
Yeah. I mean, just like an old idea Dan John had was the idea of contact conditioning, right? If you put a heavy barbell on your back, you're going to have a bruise for a little while, but then eventually the skin will adapt to the loading of the heavy barbell. If you go do jiu-jitsu, you're going to get contact conditioning across your whole body. And that's useful for a team sport athlete. If you're going to go get smacked in the paint, you know, having some contact conditioning is really big. And the way I think about a lot of these things is how much experience and how many types of experiences, and even what is the emotional loading of the experiences that you've had in different relationships of your body to other people's bodies. Like, did you see the Anthony Edwards block where he hit his head on the rim recently?
That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he landed on the other player, his foot landed on the other player's stomach. And like my gut was like, oh, cause I was like, my ankle would just be destroyed by that. Right. But if he's organized, if his body has been exposed to enough reps of that kind of thing, he's going to have much better neural control of the tension level in his ankle when it hits, and how that's distributed to the rest of the structure. So he's going to be able to take that fall. Right. And he took that fall, and he's taken lots of falls like that and not gotten injured. Right. People don't realize how much it's not like a structural characteristic. It's not like he just has, you know, maybe he has really great ligaments, but so much of it is actually great awareness. Mm-hmm. And no amount of Mikan drills or three cone drills or agility ladders or shots or dunks in isolation is going to give you the type of awareness that allows you to hit your head on the rim, be off balance, land on another player, and bounce up uninjured. Like, so where are you feeding the athlete a safe, scalable exposure to all of the different ways that their structure can end up interacting with another athlete? And that's where something like contact improv or roughhousing, where martial arts can be extraordinarily valuable. And that's where I would say that what we're doing with roughhousing is a better donor sport to athleticism in general than any specific martial art is.
Yeah, that was actually the closing question I was going to ask you was, like, for sports that are inherently contact driven, I mean, it just goes with that. Like, there's roughhousing built in, the contact prep and all those types of things of the sport, and then the contact itself. And, you know, we're talking a little bit about like improvisation pieces within that. Sports that aren't naturally contact driven, though, or you could just say even like general population. What's your thoughts on the value? Like, if it's, basketball, I guess a collision, let's just say a sport with less contact, or maybe it's a sport with no contact, tennis. I don't know. It's tennis or something like that. What are your thoughts on like the value of like a roughhousing based activity? I mean, obviously this is something we should get as kids. I know you talked with Jordan extensively at length on that and how much we need that. But as athletes get older, just thoughts on integrating in a way that I guess feels safe. Just any thoughts on non-contact sports, but the value for those individuals.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a general human thing. Going through a walk in the woods is good for you. You know, it's not very specific to being a sprinter, but it'll donate to your well-being, and that matters in the world. I think there's more advantages as we're looking at it. Like even something like tennis, you're going to end up in weird and awkward positions. And some level of roughhousing is going to expose you to those positions potentially with more regularity than you might get from purely your tennis practice. And having that can be really valuable. And having that thing we were talking about how we scale the ability to interact with people and how that allows us to grow into all of these dynamic relationships of the body to other spaces. And that's why I think parkour and roughhousing, you know, and some kind of object manipulation practices, those are just so fundamental as the donor sports to everything that we do. Mm. But then there's these other layers of it, which is like, people need touch. They need connection. They need fun, right? Yesterday I was training with a group of my students, and I had to drive from Seattle, and I had trained a couple days earlier and tweaked my back just a little bit doing a big jump out of a tree. And so it was a 2-hour drive. I started to warm up and I was feeling kind of achy and not, it was taking me a while to be ready to do the kind of things that I really like to do. And I went over and I ended up wrestling with one of my good friends, right? And I just was, you know, just doing some light flow rolling, basically. And afterwards, I was just, it just dialed me into my play state completely. And then I was good for the rest of the session, right? And sometimes it's just the most potent way of inviting a play state in. And whether you're playing tennis or basketball or running track, having a little bit more play, like neurologically being in a place of play, is going to result in a better session.
Yeah. I know in like swimming, which obviously you're not going to be contacting the other person unless a massive lane malfunction happened. Yep. Even using that as part of the warm-up sometimes would have a really positive effect just because people are smiling, they're laughing, you know, they're just genuinely in joy, you know, like you had talked about joy-driven, spontaneity-driven. You're accessing that state, and if nothing else, because a lot of what athletes get is not joy and spontaneity-driven, mm-hmm. especially with very rigid, you know, coaching schemes and things like that. That definitely can be the case. And so, one thing I was thinking about too, though, is like you mentioned, like the play rolling and like feeling better. Is I had heard someone talk about once, like just the human to human contact, it's almost like restorative in a way. Like as long as if it's like kind of a lower intensity in nature, just like contacting another human, like skin to skin contact, doing a little bit of that. There's just something about that, like they would said if they did that for an extended period of time or did like a basic, like a, maybe it was kind of like a low key rolling session, the next day they would just feel great. Like they felt like rejuvenated and restored.
I mean, we're social primates, right? Like we actually need touch. You know, there's research on, you know, the really, really sad situation in the Romanian orphanages, where babies just died if they didn't get touched. And, you know, we all like to think we're super rational, you know, animals, and, you know, everyone wants to be an independent leader, not needing other people, but like, hey, you actually do. And most of us are really touch starved. We don't, yeah, actually we're intimacy starved in a deep way. One of the things about modern life that's interesting is like we end up really underutilizing core things that we need while overutilizing them, right? So you get carpal tunnel because you move in one way too much. We end up with foot pain and back pain, et cetera, because we're not moving in a broad enough variety and diversity of ways, and we're moving too much in some ways, right? Sitting is a movement, actually, right? It's a physical demand on the body of a specific type, and we do too much of it, and then it hurts. In the same way, right, we are text all the time. We are on our phones all the time. We are constantly available to people. We're on email all the time. And so we're getting a little bit of social stimulus constantly, of very low value as far as intimacy. And a lot of times we're exhausted by that, and then we don't want to do the work that's going to allow us to have deep intimacy with other people, which is what we're actually craving. So in a weird way, we end up hyper-socialized and completely under-socialized. And something like a rough and tumble practice just brings us into deep connection with other people really quickly. And it's something that we're all actually really hungry for. So I think one of the things that I thought about for years is this idea that a warm-up should be as much psychological and emotional as it is physical. And so if you get your swimmers wrestling, it really has nothing structurally to do with what they're going to do. I mean, maybe you're using their lats, right? But like fundamentally, it's about as far away from the activity as possible. Like I can talk about tennis and, hey, you ended up in some weird funky position. Maybe that's going to come out in contact improv, but no, that's not going to happen in swimming. But what is the spirit of the team as they enter the practice? What is the level of flow they're experiencing? How connected do they feel? And what we've seen with our events is that the more deeply connected a group of people feels to each other, the more easily they can access their own greatest capacities. And so that's where it can play a role, even in something that's completely physically unrelated.
Yeah. I'm sure too, just with like athletics and the gym, sometimes some of the things that we do, I think, are things that can resonate deeply outside of or after their career's done, you know, and like teaching people how to play when you're, you know, when the last ball goes through the hoop or whatever, or, you know, the lights go off and you go back, you go off into, I guess, normal life, you know, playing at rec leagues or whatever. But I do think that teaching people how to play and how to roughhouse and at least showing that that's important, like, and how much fun you can have. I think there's something really valuable there. And
absolutely.
So I know, you know, Rafe, I think you have like some roughhousing courses coming out or things that are I think there's a few different types, but do you want to share some about that before we finish up the podcast today?
Yeah. So we've got, we just released for the first time a series of roughhousing courses. So the stuff that I originally developed was very much martial art oriented, and that made it hard to share through an online system. Because there's just some certain sensitivities that I was worried about people not having as they entered some of these more combative things. So last year, basically, we started like really dialing into like what would be the fundamentals that anyone could start with anywhere. And particularly, this was built coordination with my friend Aaron Cantor, who's also been on this podcast. And we did the same set of drills for three seminars where we walked through them over and over and over again. And then what we did was we got together and we basically filmed the drills that we drilled down on through that and through the workshops, the games. And we filmed them first as a kind of general introduction that anyone could use. And then we went back and reviewed them specifically as like, how would you facilitate this between children? So like your kids can play together or a group of kids that you work with. What do you need to know to help them support each other in playing well together? And then how could you play with the kid, right? So what are the types of games that are opened up for a parent and a child or a teacher and a child? And then we looked at specifically how you could use rough and tumble play actually in the context of intimate partnership to build connection. And so we built these three courses that are available now at, and I think that they're the first of their kind. I don't think anybody's ever put out online courses on rough and tumble play on the market before. And it's, you know, over a decade of my work and a similar length of Aaron's work, like really digging into it. Aaron talks about them as a yoga of communication. It's like a set of asanas for how we communicate with bodies. And I think it's an incredibly powerful thing to have available, and I'm really excited about it. So yeah, people can check that out if they want to come experience it in person. We've got workshops and retreats coming up. So that's what's going on with the roughhousing.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure those, based off of my experiences with yourself and Aaron, at both the Return to the Source and the workshop, I'm sure the courses are awesome. So I know, yeah, the, that type of, the roughhousing and like the, learning to play, I know it's certainly been helpful as a coach, but it's also been really helpful for me just as a father. I would actually say, you know, if you ask me where it really counts, I mean, yes, as a coach, certainly it's good to have fun and find ways for athletes to have fun. But like for my, to like be a rhino and like attack my son and he's like laughing and always, and they always ask for me to be a rhino, you know, stuff like that. And just like thinking about that spirit was inspired by the last workshop I went to with Aaron. And so it's such good stuff. I mean, it's so, it's something that hits both, you know, playing with your kids, but it also can resonate in, hey, here's the warm up today for athletics. And just, just that like joy driven. I wrote down joy driven.
Yeah.
It's great, that keeps coming back. So, such good stuff, Rafe.
Thank you. Yeah. My philosophy kind of centers on the idea that the ultimate purpose of these practices long term is that we can love our experience of being more. We can fall more in love with being alive. And seeking the joy in your practice is a really powerful start.
Absolutely. Well, hey, thank you so much for being on the show again here, Rafe. It was really great to have you.
Yeah. Thank you so much again for hosting me, Joel. And I look forward to seeing you next time.
Thanks for tuning in to another podcast. I appreciate you listening, and I'll see you next week.